Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by John Hardy, Chief Executive of ITN. John started his career in marketing, working for Procter & Gamble, where he led their European cosmetics business and was responsible for household name products like Max Factor and Oil of Olay. He jumped to the media in 1997, becoming commercial director at ITV Network Centre during a period of significant digital disruption. He looked after all of their commercial operations, was responsible for ITV2 and online, and helped turn it from a regional to a national brand. John then moved to Walt Disney TV. Covering Europe, the Middle East and Africa, he more than doubled the unit's revenues and launched their very successful Cinemagic TV channel. Appointed CEO of ITN in 2009, he has overseen consistent growth, put his stamp on their distinctive news bulletins, and significantly expanded their productions arms, which now creates TV adverts, online content, and sports programming. John, thank you for joining me.
Oh, you're most welcome.
That took quite a while to get out, actually. There's a lot there, isn't it? Did you ever dream that you would end up chief executive of ITN when you started out your career at the beginning?
No, I don't think so. I think that, oddly enough, though, When I started university, I was kind of interested in maybe journalism, but my real interest in life was always television. And although it seems a circuitous route to have come through, I was 14 years at Procter & Gamble and then just ended up in ITV. Actually, television was always my interest. So at university, I was the head of programmes of Glasgow University Student Television. And among my compatriots at the time were people who went on to forged really good careers in television. Hamish Barber, who created Location, John Nicholson, now MP, but most famous probably Stephen Moffat, the creator of Sherlock and Doctor Who.
Fantastic programmes.
Absolutely brilliant, and others too. So television was my interest, and I guess I hoped I would end up forging some kind of career in TV and entertainment. I then took a short 14-year detour through Procter & Gamble before finding my way back to my natural home.
Did you always feel it was a detour then when you kind of started off it? How did you end up at Procter & Gamble then?
Well, it was very simple. You know, I graduated in 1983 and, like most people, applied to join the BBC and didn't even get a first interview, despite the fact of I thought I had a relatively interesting CV for that. Such was not that I carry a big chip in my shoulder, but maybe just a little one. So I applied, and getting into television was very, very difficult back then. I'm not saying it's easy now, but it was particularly difficult. And I had to work out what to do. And I took part in a legendary marketing vacation course run by Procter & Gamble in my final year at university. And actually, apart from BBC, it was the only job I applied for. And I just turned up one day for an interview, was offered a job there and then, and spent the next 14 years. And from time to time, I thought maybe I want to do something else. But it's a pretty good company, and I had quite a good time there. Eventually the day came. Headhunters would call me back then, and, you know, invite me to take jobs in consulting. I was offered a job by McKinsey. I was actually offered a job by EMI Records to be director of international artistic development. But although I love music, it wasn't quite the natural fit. And my great career plan was to sit by the telephone and hope one day somebody in television would call. And one day they did. And that was 1997.
So how did that happen then? Did you feel your time at Procter & Gamble had come to a kind of natural end, or was this call entirely unexpected?
It could have been it could have been 2 years before or 2 years afterwards. And I had literally said to various headhunters, I'm not really interested in selling beer or whiskey or soft drinks or whatever, but I would be interested in making a move into media. And one of those conversations did result 6 months later when ITV was going through a big change at this time. You know, that was the 90s was still a time of big internecine warfare among the various ITV companies. But they decided in 1997 they really needed to try to run ITV Network as a more cohesive single business unit.
It seems obvious now, doesn't it, in hindsight, all these years later, well, that there should be one ITV.
Back then, there were still, the point I was off the job, there were eight companies, it became seven ITV companies, and they much more value prized their local name, Granada and Carlton. And actually, the expression ITV hardly appeared on screen.
It was like Yorkshire Television, Tyne Tees. I remember that as a youngster growing up.
And they were powerful regional brands, and there was a role for that. But also, those were the days when ITV virtually had a monopoly in television advertising. It wasn't long before that that ITV actually controlled the advertising for Channel 4 as well as ITV. This is ancient history now, of course. But anyway, by the time we get to 97, it became a more competitive world. Multi-channel TV was growing very significantly. So audience ratings on all the channels were declining. There was dissatisfaction among advertisers who thought that ITV wasn't trying hard enough to compete with the BBC. So the ITV companies decided to put in place a new team, and there was Richard Eyre was chief executive, David Liddiment was the director of programmes, and I came in as marketing and commercial director.
Some big names then. Was that part of it, like you've alluded to, a deliberate initiative to step up ITV's game?
It was. I mean, and behind us, we then recruited, just three levels up from where now, a whole new team to run the ITV network, as it was called at the time. It was a very exciting time. One of the first things we did after a quick strategic review was to decide to set audience targets, publicly aware audience targets, and believe for peak time. Because we essentially ran part of the schedule. We ran prime time, the evening, we ran daytime. And we were very much focused on our audience performance between 7 and 10.30. And so we set three-year goals for 1998, 99, and 2000. And the audience share targets we set were 38%, 39%, and 40%.
Can you imagine suggesting that now?
You know, it's a lifetime ago, and it is the best part of 20 years ago, and the world has changed dramatically. And we came pretty close. This is ancient history, but against a target of 38% in 98, we did 37.8, I think. Against 39, we did 39.1. And then actually in the third year, we fell back a little bit. Rather than do 40%, we only did 38.8%. And those were the years when we brought in things like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and Cold Feet and Pop Stars.
Never heard of these shows.
It was incredible. Yeah, you're far too young to remember these things. But it was an electric period in ITV, a very successful period from most points of view. Some challenges too.
But it seems to be, like you say, a heyday, because you were creatively very ambitious and doing very successfully, as well as commercially.
Well, that's right. There was a real sense of ambition and a real sense of competitiveness. And back then, we set our targets very much focused on the BBC. Now, although, you know, from a business point of view, ITV competes with all the other commercial broadcasters, the view at that time was that in order to show confidence to the advertisers, we wanted to show we could take market share, audience share from the BBC. And actually, after those first 3 years, we set a new target, which was in prime time, we wanted to have a 10 percentage point gap against the BBC. It's huge. And those were the days when actually BBC was floundering somewhat. They called Millionaire the exocet of television scheduling.
So it was a good show. It was
brilliant.
I admit to watching it.
I mean, we all have our anecdotes, but I remember, because I was responsible for both marketing the network, but also for buying the programmes. So I had a team responsible for the budget. And back then it was a little short of £700 million as we ran. And, you know, early on one day, somebody came into my office and said, it was David Lubin, and said, we want to schedule this new quiz show. It's called Cash Mountain. So they're going to come in and see you. But they've got a brilliant idea, which is they're going to give £1 million away in maximum. And up until that point, the record giveaway was, I think, £72,000 or something. So we're going to give away £1 million. We're going to give away these big prizes. But the great news is this. We only have to pay for the production of the show, because all the prize money will be gathered by people making premium rate telephone calls in order to take part in the show, and that will raise all the prize money.
Please ask the bill payer's permission before making any calls.
Precisely. So this had never been done before, and so I had to look into it a little bit, and there was no precedent for this. You know, obviously, premium rate phone calls existed, but nobody had done anything like this. So we accepted doing it. I struck a deal with Paul Smith at Celador at the time to say, we'll try to take insurance on this, but if we have to go over budget, we split the difference 50-50. Because I wanted to make sure that the questions were set difficult enough so it wasn't be like every single night we were giving away £1 million.
Well,
and to their credit, they did it. And they are the geniuses behind. Celador really did it. But the other thing was, we were trying to take ITV up market at the time, and so a few people said the name Cash Mountain doesn't sound like a very up market name. So it was actually ITV Network Centre. They said, well, what could be an alternative name? It wasn't me. I wish I could say it was me. It wasn't. We kind of did one of these emails around the office, and somebody in the office came up with the idea of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and the rest is history.
It was an amazing show.
You know, absolutely brilliant.
And of course, it was very successfully sold all around the world. I mean, it's available in dozens of countries, isn't it?
Nothing to do with me, I'm afraid, because, you know, this was an independent commission. So ITV bought the show and had the success on as a broadcasting show, but it was Celador who then ran the show around the world. I once went to, there was a conference in the USA, and there was it was bought by ABC, whom I later worked for, of course, or Disney. And the person at the ABC said, you would have thought that they had invented the show. And they ran it fully a year after it had been on ITV. And it was an absolute clone. Everything, down to the wardrobe, matched the wardrobe that Chris Tarrant showed. And the guy from the US said, well, we piloted the show in the UK first, and then he nearly threw something at the SOB because there was anything like it. Because it was utterly unknown. It was one of the most exciting periods ever.
And did you feel that you'd found your home industry at that point, that you were going to stay in telly for the rest of your career?
I think so. You know, I did 4 years at ITV, and we had a great time. We had some, you know, obviously some problems along the way too, because the BBC started to bite back, and Greg Digg joined, and they made some scheduling moves, and they did a few things. So and then the advertising recession hit back in about 2001.
When I think of Greg as DJ, I always think of people in meetings holding up their signs saying, cut the crap. That's the only thing I tend to, other than his dramatic resignation. Do you remember that?
Well, you know, I remember it all very clearly. I don't really know Greg at all or well. I think he was a true charismatic leader. And he focused BBC back then. I mean, he basically took the BBC and did a very simple rebranding of their multi-channel lineup from BBC One, BBC Two, BBC Three, BBC Four. He pioneered going into CBBC and CBeebies.
Because John Burt actually set up the news channel, didn't he?
John Burt launched both the news channel and online. So John did that whole modernisation. And Greg came in and did the next generation. But also he took over when On Digital collapsed, and basically they created Freeview. And Freeview was the major catalyst for digital growth in the country thereafter. And Greg, I think, can take a lot of the credit for that. So I recall him being this focused, cut straight to the chase, charismatic leader.
So you did 4 years at ITV. What came next and how did you come to move on?
Well, so 4 years seemed about the right time at ITV. And having, you say, and I think I'd found my home, that I wanted to work in television. And then the following thing occurred to me as to what I would do next. And there was an expression on a film at the time, not a great film, but an interesting expression, which is, somebody said, if I had lived in Roman times, I would choose to live in Rome. And I thought that applies to this business. If you're going to work in the television and the entertainment industry, at some point you probably want to work for one of the big Hollywood majors. That would be an interesting next step. And then I read, actually, Michael Eisner had written a book called Work in Progress about Disney and his time at Disney. And it seemed to me this is a perfect union of where television and entertainment, or entertainment meets marketing. And that's the two things that I had done. So it occurred to me that Disney would be probably a good company to join. And somehow magically the telephone rang one day and I was offered a job to be the head of Europe for Walt Disney Television, and really jumped at the chance.
So what were the challenges there then?
Well, the day job and what I did mostly was running Disney channels. There were other bits and pieces involved, but that was it. And the Disney channels, I went in 2001, and Disney channels had launched in about 1995. It went in fact then. So they'd existed and they expanded through Europe by the time I turned up. The issue was this, that my predecessors were very clever businessmen, had struck fantastic carriage deals all over Europe with satellite companies, sometimes exclusive, and all of them were based on being in the premium section. So those were the days when the satellite companies were all focused on Premier League football, movies, and the premium offer.
Yeah.
And then the basic came along with, because that's what differentiated them from the cable companies. Disney Channel had been sold into being part of the premium package, and made a lot of money, relatively speaking, for that. The problem was this, is that by the time I got there, Disney Channel was in a total of 9 million homes in the whole of Europe. And what it didn't do was act as, you know, a massive marketing force for the whole of the Walt Disney Company and its product. The dilemma was, if you were to go to what was then called basic, then you wouldn't get anywhere near as much money.
But you'd get the audience.
So there were those in the company that said, forget about Disney Channel being a profitable business in itself. Just go out into the widest distribution and just be a kind of a marketing barker channel for the rest of Disney. So that was a challenge. And what the strategy we came up with back then, and we did one of these, I did one of these Venn diagrams that said, what we want to be is a profitable business in its own right as Disney Channel, a massively broadly reaching marketing platform from the whole Walt Disney, and a content creator that creates its own material that becomes franchises for the whole of the company. So we don't just want to sell other people's movies, we want to sell our own things. And so we changed the whole business model with all of the multi-channel operators across Europe, and we went to what we call I used to call the pyramid model, but some people didn't like that, a tiered portfolio. So we would be, there would be in some countries we'd be in free-to-air, like we launched free-to-air in Spain. In others we'd be broadly basic, and then we had other channels which would be in the premium tier. So that would stop people from churning down from the top tier to basic. So you mentioned that I created a channel called Disney Cinemagic, which is, I think, now called Sky Disney in this country, which was where we put our movies. But the main channel, Disney Channel, became basic. So we grew, over a period of just about 3 years, we went from 9 million households to 45 million households. But we made more money doing it, and we expanded into more countries. We expanded into Poland and Africa and Turkey, as well as we went broader reach, and we doubled our reach in the UK, and we did all that. Fantastic. So that made us a much more powerful franchise vehicle for the rest of the company. But also happened that the programs we were making for Disney Channel really started to work. And we had a lit upon the idea of focusing on what was then called the tween audience. And the two major hits we then had were High School Musical and Hannah Montana.
Both massive brands.
Massive brands. The process worked is we would make these sitcoms for Disney Channel, and every year, you know, the US, they were the geniuses that created these things, but they would have about six scripts ready for pilot. And one year, and they would send them around the world, and Hannah Montana landed on my desk. And I was a massive fan of the Monkees. In the 60s, and I thought, you know what, where music meets kind of sitcom for kids is going to be dynamite everywhere. But actually, the majority of what was for another show. So I said, I will put up the money to make the pilot of Hannah Montana. And it went ahead, but it took 18 months after that to make even the pilot, because it took over a year to find Miley Cyrus.
Reality is now, you know, even gone beyond the fiction, because she's a real pop star now and globally recognised.
And she pretty quickly did become a star. I mean, the series was a huge hit. And so actually she did a tour, which were the kind of, I think it was called Both Sides, but she would do half the concert as Hannah Montana and half the concert as Miley Cyrus. And of course, eventually Hannah Montana disappeared and Miley Cyrus became the global legend that she is. So that was a mission. It was so I was 8 years at Disney, essentially focused on just expanding out Disney Channel, and to a large extent making it the global brand it is. The European side of it, you know, was I had a boy, the people in the US. I didn't run it worldwide. I only ran the European part of it. Rich Ross was my boss at Disney Channel.
And that was the first kind of global media brand that you worked for. Did you find the culture empowering? Was it easy to get things done? Because you hear tales of people who work in big companies in any sector that, you know, they lose that agility. It's like wading through treacle sometimes just to get anything done.
Yeah, no, I didn't find that. I think that, you know, you hear stories of these big, I worked for two major American companies. And I found in both of those companies, even as a relatively junior executive in Procter and a middle manager, I guess, in Disney, I had plenty of access to Bob Iger and Ian Sweeney and people like that. You could get things done. Yes, there are complications, and these can be quite political organizations. But oddly, I found it wasn't difficult to get agreement on the big things. You know, I did one negotiation with a major satellite platform, which was an 11-year deal, which was worth $1 billion. And it was like I'd send a couple of emails updating it. We just did it. But other things, sometimes you find things that surprise you are more difficult to get done or cause more concern in the big organizations. And I've said before, in the jungle, it's not the tigers that get you, it's the mosquitoes. So it can be small matters that cause you more aggravation or frustration than the big things that really drive the business. But certainly the big difference between being an executive running a part of something like Disney versus being chief executive here is, you know, at least in my chair, we're not held back by corporate politics. We just make decisions and try to do things.
So after 8 years, what came next? Why did you feel it was time to move on?
Well, I'd been executive vice president running a decent size part of Disney Television, but I wanted the chief executive experience. Really to, you know, given the choice between just running a bigger part of a major multinational or running a smaller, but really running a smaller company, I wanted to do the second of those.
The book stopping with you.
Yeah. And, you know, I actually remember the day that I just was looking at the media press and I saw that the chief executive at the time was leaving, and I thought ITN. And of course, I'd known ITN from my days at ITV. Clearly, so I thought I had an idea what ITN was.
Well, they provided you with your news,
as we do now, and as of course, as the commercial director was responsible for, you know, the oversight of the commercial terms of that. So I knew ITN, I thought at the time that'd be interesting. Sure enough, the phone rang and I was offered the job. So I mean, it turned out to be a little different from what I had anticipated in advance.
Better or worse?
Well, the truth is, there's no secret that ITN... So I was offered the job at the end of 2008 and started in June 1st, 2009. So it's 7 years now. And it's no secret that the company was much more challenged than I think really anybody had appreciated it was. It was actually after I had resigned from Disney but was working through some notice that the pension deficit really surfaced for ITN. So that was a challenge. And, you know, it was also back then was, you know, there was some change. There was a bit of a pressure on advertising revenues. And ITN was kind of losing some business, and really the strategy wasn't working out so well. So it was, I turned up that what was I thought was going to be a growth opportunity, which turned out to be a turnaround first. We had to get turnaround first and then move into the growth cycle, which we've now done. It was more of a slightly more crisis management mentality when I turned up at ITN. That's long gone, I'm pleased to say. It's a very confident organisation there.
Tell us about your plans for growth then. Like you say, you've mitigated the problems at the beginning, that kind of crisis management. You're going into growth phase now, and you're diversifying what ITN is doing as well. Tell us about that.
So the journey, as the Americans say, we've been on was, what we focused on at the start was, it was a very simple proposition. I mean, ITN had tried to diversify into some areas, but not very successfully and certainly not profitably. So the first thought we had was, look, if we're good at one thing at ITN, it's making television news. So our success had better be built on that. Otherwise, what are we doing in business? So that we kind of coined a mantra back then, which was, we will be world-class television news and business arising naturally from that. And we focused on improving our news programs, improving our profit margins from our news programs, improving our relationships with our customers. And we did that. We improved the profitability of our broadcast news group. We won back Channel 5. And so essentially before we started, the profit contribution of the news division was below the corporate overhead. Now it became profitable and very much more successful. And at the same time, as we try to build businesses arising naturally, what happens is that they worked very well. So at the point of this year, we realized simply categorizing our future business as a byproduct of broadcast news doesn't capture at all the scale and the size of the opportunity. So we recalibrated our mission to be what we say it is now, is that we're focused on two divisions and five businesses. Broadcast news is still the largest part of what we do. But television programming, particularly factual, advertising production and branded content, sports production, and digital content. And each of those individual businesses is as big as the total productions business we started with. In fact, bigger than that we started with all those years ago. But it still all comes from a single organizing proposition for ITN, which is all our businesses are about high-impact, authentic storytelling. That's what we do best in television news, and I think we do better than anybody else in the television news business. We do great journalism, which tells the stories, and we make a big impact. As we've moved into, whether it's television programming or whatever we do, it's those same elements that make us successful. So we move quickly. We are very informal, so people like working with us. But we are great at storytelling, and whether that storytelling is for a 60-minute program for the BBC or an overnight election program, whether that's for making commercials for Barclays or Thomas Cook or branded content, whether it's dealing with sports providers, it all arises out of the same essential qualities that always reflected the best of what ITN was for. So we're expanding as quickly as we can in those areas, both in the UK and also very significantly in the United States. So having grown, I mean, this year our revenues will probably end up being about 40% larger than the business we started with in 2010, which for a 60-year-old company, and it's all organic, no acquisitions in there, is not too shabby. But we think we can grow another 50% on top of that over the next 5 to 6 years by building, because there's a lot of business out there in television production. People say, advertising, why advertising? But you think, advertising market? Advertising is Google. Advertising is Facebook. Advertising is where the future is. And our role in all these other markets, is to look at the big emerging global media companies and create services that they need. So we've got some of the best in the business today. We've got ITV and Channel 4 and Channel 5. We work for Sky. We're increasingly working for the BBC. And these are the big beasts in the jungle. Beyond that, I also want to work for the biggest brands, the biggest advertising agencies like WPP, the biggest advertising clients like Barclays and Suzuki. I want to be serving American clients. And so we're working with CBS and CNN, and we, of course, like everyone, we're talking to Netflix. So our role in the future will be expanding from what ITN is essentially about to this massively growing international market of media companies, whether they be classic broadcasters that we deal with, whether they be converging forces in telecoms, you know, so who knows, one of these days maybe we'll do some work for BT and others like that. So we're very bullish about our growth, but we're very grounded on doing what we're good at doing. So I've said before, and I'll say again, I'm not planning right now to work on the next Game of Thrones. Ask me again in 5 years about that. So we're still very tightly focused on what we know we're good at doing.
Do you think it's challenging to kind of maintain the audience levels of your flagship programmes like News at 10? You recently kind of re-engineered the whole programme and had a more conversational style with Tom Bradby. A lot of people really liked it, including myself, but there were a lot of critics as well. Maybe those people just don't like change. But it's not even just about that. It's about kind of appointment to view news. You know, the challenge of rolling news. ITN had famously had a rolling news channel which you closed down, but there's the internet. There's a lot of, you know, I come home at night and watch News at 10 for a different experience because I already know what's happened. Was that a deliberate strategy then to reframe News at 10 to someone who's watching who already knows what's happened, who already knows the news?
You see, what you just said was, there is your answer, which is the people who are watching bulletins, the major bulletins on ITV, Channel 4, Channel 5, BBC, are not watching to get the headline news. They're not getting, it's not about the breaking news that happened, because by and large, even if you've been out and about on your mobile device, you've heard the headline. So the bulletin is here to exist for a long time to come, but it's not about an either or. It's not about, will we hold on to the bulletins while the inevitable forces of digital expansion will eat away? Any news organization, any news brand has got to be both powerful on television and powerful in digital. So in terms of the audiences, our audience of Channel 4 News have actually grown in the last couple of years, audience share. Audience for ITV across our bulletins is at least as good this year as it was last year. So obviously there was, in the previous 20 years, a seismic shift in the move towards multi-channel, which brought with it a decline in the overall size of the main channels, ITV1, BBC1 and so forth. But I think we're now at a point where the audiences for the major bulletins are probably can leveled out, and there's no reason why they have to continue to decline. Clearly what you do in terms of the nature of those programmes must evolve with the time. And that's why, you know, what people are looking for is a well-ordered news programme that puts the different news stories into order, into context, has a combination of reporting and gets the big pictures and tells the stories, but has got very thoughtful analysis and, as important as anything, is challenging. Because it's not, clearly that's the difference between us and, let's say, other people out there, is the ability to hold power to account and to do that intelligently and to shine a light on the matters of the day. So the audiences do come to News at 10 and to Channel 4 News and all the rest of our services, even knowing, even having seen the big picture of the day, whether they've seen it on breaking news. But in addition to that, is you have to be very expansive digitally. So actually the expansion in digital in the last few years has been great news for us, and very truly, because of this. 20-odd years ago, every television news service and channel created a website. The challenge for our websites was that they were up against monoliths like the BBC or even The Guardian, investing massively in building destination websites. And a website which is essentially the accompaniment to a television programme will always find it difficult to really compete against these massive destinations. The great thing about the growth of both mobile and social media is it creates a platform that can arrive effortlessly to an audience. You no longer have to have either a 24/7 news channel or a massive destination website. What you do is you take your journalism and adapt it to the mobile social media audience, and you get fantastic numbers from that if you do it appropriately. So you take Channel 4 News. We made significant changes to what we did digitally to Channel 4 News just over a year ago or so. And the numbers on Facebook alone are astonishing. I think it's in the last 3 months we had close on 300 million views of Channel 4 News alone on Facebook. I think 10-to-1 ratio compared to Vice News, 10-to-1 on Facebook, just Facebook. More than BBC gets on Facebook. By the way, that is all hardcore, high-fibre Channel 4 News journalism. This is not, you know, curating video of cute kittens doing things and putting it under the brand name. This is political stories. This is stories in Syria. This is major articles from around the world, but done cleverly, so that they work for the digital audience. So we've learned how to use YouTube and particularly Facebook, how you edit differently and correctly, how you put it into a square rather than a rectangle, the clever use of subtitles, and not just subtitles you've overdone, but writing in a different way, editing in a different way. So the same essential story done in a different way for an audience that by and large is looking at it in mobile and is probably not listening because you're on the, because some people put the headphones in, some people don't. Anyway, that's a little bit of our secret sauce. So for the future, it's not about either or, it's about both. Because the television platform is still, an hour, half, we do an hour of broadcasting on ITV, 6:30 and News at 10, an hour on Channel 4 News, Channel 5 News, 5 o'clock and 6:30. And that programming will exist. I'll put a month's salary here now against anyone who bets against me, not just 5 years from now, but 10 years from now. The major bulletin organised programmes will still be the most watched video news in this country. And in addition to that, the digital audience will massively grow, and it will be particularly strong for the younger audience, but both will continue to survive and be required.
But the tastes seem to be changing on traditional broadcasts, because if you watch BBC News at 10, for example, Hugh Edwards is a great anchor, but it's what I would call the traditional. He reads the news. We had Sir Trevor MacDonald on the podcast recently, and he deplored the fact that we seem to be moving to a more chatty, personality-driven news. I mean, Tom Bradby gives his own opinion when he's in the anchor's chair. We all know that Jon Snow's a bit of a lefty, and he must eat muesli and cycles in, etc., etc., and you kind of choose that. That's part of the warmth depth and personality of the programme. But is that a deliberate policy to differentiate yourself from the increasingly more traditional BBC?
Well, clearly what we've done is very deliberate in all those programmes. First of all, to be clear, by the way, everything we do in our news programmes completely complies with all the Ofcom code. And the thing about Ofcom is it's very easy to raise complaints. So in terms of due accuracy, due impartiality, due fairness, all those things, we are unblemished and unchallenged in terms of anything that people sometimes, and from time to time people do make comments. And I think they do work. It seems to me that for a modern audience, it seems odd that you have a news presenter, let's call it an anchor, who is talking about the major news of the day, who has got 25 years of experience of covering world events, of dealing with politics at the highest level, and then they have no scope at all to make any kind of comment from their experience and knowledge in journalism. It seems to me that the general public out there is interested in not just, if you like, the contained reporting of these are the events of the day, and then we go over to our specialist correspondents. Is that actually some of the conversations among our presenters and our specialist correspondents are fascinating, given their experiences. They always have to get the balance right at all times in everything they're talking about. And I do think there is an appetite. I think we've seen there's a significant appetite for that. And so we don't turn... It's not a chat show. It's not just... I mean, I think people overstate, by the way, the extent to which Tom or other people are kind of giving opinions. They're not just sitting there and opining. It's not editorial. It's not... And by the way, it's never, here's my view of how the world should be run. They're typically commenting on it would be things like, you know, how big a deal is this for the Labour Party? And that's appropriate. That's due impartiality still to make. The rules of Ofcom or not never, ever, ever, ever express an opinion or observation. It's about due impartiality, due accuracy, due fairness. I think we do that very well. So, yes, I think there is an appetite for that. And I think it works quite well. So I'm very proud of both of you've talked about both those services. I'm very proud of all of our services. But I think we strike the balance exactly right by having intelligent, experienced journalists who are able to bring their experience to bear, but at the same time, we're not a newspaper or on television. We are not biased, and we don't take sides like that. We hold all sides to account equally and with as much gusto. Whatever you think about the political leanings, you can determine from choice of transport of any of our people.
well put.
Yeah.
There you go. Tell us, what's a typical week for you?
They're not that typical. I sometimes say that, you know, I run a relatively modest business, but I'll put my weekly diary up against those of any FTSE 100 chief executive and say, you may run a bigger business, my week is more interesting. So it does range in the course of a week from every morning I chair a 10 o'clock cross-company editorial meeting, so I know what the agenda is across company, how we're working at cooperating on the things that need to be cooperated on, from news gathering and technical, where all the legal issues are, where any of the safety issues are. So it kind of kicks off with the news and the news agenda. I may then have a meeting about a dangerous deployment into Syria, or a meeting about we're going to do some undercover filming for a show for Channel 5, Paul Connolly Investigates.
That must be difficult, because you've got to balance the safety of the reporter with the desire to actually tell the story and let the wider world know what's going on, because the safe choice would be to say, you know, stay here at Gray's Inn Road and have a nice cup of tea, son. But you've got to send them there, but knowing that they could be put in harm's way.
My experience is that the difficulty sometimes is holding them back from going into difficult places. These are all very ambitious, determined people, you know, and over the 7 years I've been here, you can imagine we've had one or two incidents with issues. So, you know, so actually we've spent a lot of time on getting the right balance and protocols for safety, particularly in what we call red assignments, because we want to go and report. It's our job to go and report from these areas. But the world, I think, has truly become a more dangerous place because it's become a less predictable place.
And the old rules seem to be being set aside in places like the so-called Islamic State, where reporters are not only routinely killed, but killed deliberately on camera to humiliate them and spread yet further fear.
Indeed. You know, and there are places that we that our people cannot go now that could have gone a few years ago. There are some accepted practices. There were times where experienced journalists would tell you, I can go into this village because I made an agreement with a chief there, and that's solid. And now you can't. The things you could relied upon in the past don't apply as much any longer. So it's a more dangerous world. It's a less predictable world, and the situation on the ground changes very quickly. So you might find there's an area, and I don't know, the DRC, that 6 months ago was absolutely fine just to drive to, but things have changed since then. So you always have to have up-to-date assessments of any area you're going into. So there's nothing more important to us than the life and the safety of our people. And by the way, we have exactly the same policy to anybody we employ locally. So it's not just our employed ITN staff, but if we're employing local stringers or local journalists and contacts, we insist that all the safety precautions they take are exactly the same as the precautions we take with our own people. But we don't want to not report. And it's important to report these stories. I mean, so if you consider the ITN Productions' incredible story last year, Escape from ISIS, where we worked for many, many, many months, and we were dealing with people in Raqqa, who are inside Raqqa, are communicating with us and doing secret filming and making arrangements for escape, for people to escape from Raqqa. And then we also filmed in the outside of those who are organising for escapes. You imagine the dangers involved with somebody living under ISIS in Raqqa.
Incredible.
Communicating with our people. So, but these are incredibly important stories that have to be brought to the world. And that's what our people are dealing with in a weekly basis, if not a daily basis.
Back to your typical week then. We got to your 10 o'clock meeting.
So it's the daily news agenda across. Maybe there's a negotiation with one of... We just signed a half-year deal with Channel 5, so I'm very much involved with those things. And maybe then have a meeting where we are making I've been asked to... My people have asked me to comment on a pitch they're making to a major advertising client. So it ranges from, we're pitching a new sports contract, or we're dealing with a negotiation and pay with the unions, or it's a meeting about where our pension fund sits and so forth. So the variety, it's everything involved in running a company, but it just ranges from how are we handling Brexit and the reporting of that, all the way through to tell me what we're doing for Club 1830 next year and everything. And by the way, those are not opposites. They're just the kind of show the range of what ITN's about now and indeed what I do.
I appreciate you'll enjoy the whole mix of it, but do you have a kind of favourite aspect of your job? Is it when you're in dealing with the journalist or the creative side, or do you prefer the more kind of corporate deal-making? What floats your boat, if I could put it as brutally as that?
No, I think that it's invidious to choose one of those things. I mean, when we've been doing breaking major investigations, where we're making, allegations, particularly against a major organisation. We did undercover filming in Channel 4 News. On Yarl's, we did detention centre, and that was months of planning and going undercover. That was incredible to see that come to fruition. You know, the day that ITV News got the pictures after the killing of drummer Lee Rigby and the decision to broadcast them and broadcast Ad Bellagio holding the knives and blood, and to do that, that was exhilarating too. Winning a contract for the Football League, to win a 3-year contract to film almost all of the Football League matches and take ITN to a game-changing place, that was pretty exciting too. So, you pick my favourite, it's like pick among my children. They're all my favourites, really. And yes, it is the variety of the job. But, once in a while, when the topic of conversation is how we're reporting on, events in the Middle East, how we're reporting on the change.
You can't win.
Somebody who, who thought it was exciting being the young brand manager of Fairy Liquid 30 years ago, to find yourself seriously in those discussions. Sometimes I pinch myself and say, do I really do this for a living? And yes, I do.
I've spoken to quite a few editors and they say, look, if both sides of the argument, if an equal number of them think you've been unfair to them on either side of the argument, then you're probably doing a good job.
I don't subscribe to that theory.
All right, what's your theory?
I know it's typically said by the BBC, if everybody is angry with us, we must be doing something right. I don't think that's it. I don't think offending everyone equally is actually a good barometer of the accuracy or the impartiality of a journalism. I think you have to hold yourself accountable. The Ofcom code, and I know I've quoted it a few times in law, it's pretty well-written stuff. The doctrine of fairness that says reach for all the facts. Don't just report a story and gather together those facts which seem to support a particular case. Go to all the inconvenient facts too. Make sense of all of those. Present those. Challenge everyone. Then you've done your job. And it's not enough just to say, we've annoyed enough people, so we're doing a good thing.
Penultimate question then, John. What are the kind of challenging aspects for the job personally? I imagine it's quite long hours, is it? What if you were to grumble about the job, what would you say?
I don't find too much that bores me in the job. If anything, what we've done after 7 years, it would have been, is the job finished? But actually, we've kind of re-energized ourselves to a whole new vision of what the company is. So, problems emerge all the time. And we're a small enough company that, if a satellite dish breaks down abroad in the middle of one of our programs, I will have a meeting about that too. And you would rather that everything that you've put in place operates. It's a bit unfair to pick on operations for that. There's day-to-day stuff that has to be done. I took part in I found myself in a discussion about how many insects are getting into one of our toilets the other week there. I had no idea. But actually, if you're working the part of the building that's doing that, you might think, is this chief executive stuff? Well, we're a small enough company, it turns out it is chief executive stuff.
Can accuse you of being aloof then if you get into that level of detail.
Maybe not. So, but actually that's part of the... That's the fun is that I suppose that if when you're running the massive corporate entities, and I've worked for some of them, it can become almost academic. Whereas a job like this is everything from negotiating multi-year, multi-million pound deals through to how do you deal with a fly infestation? I can talk about that if you want, because it's a fascinating topic about flies and their seasonality.
I'm sure it is, and I'm sure you're an expert on it now. Final question then, and I've never got anyone to successfully answer this, so I appreciate you might want to sidestep it, but what's next for you? What would be the next career move? I mean, I'll be honest, I want to be Director General of the BBC. Is that a job that you would aspire to do? I think you'd be a replacement for Tony Hall when he wants to move on.
I don't think it is something I'd do next, to be honest. And maybe in 10 or 15 years' time, that it sounds very arrogant to say that. No, look, I think that I've been working for 33 years now, and I tend to think the best career plan is to do a great job of what you do. When the time is right and the opportunity is there, you will know it, rather than daydream about what one might do next. I think I love television and entertainment, though. I mean, I've grown very quickly to love journalism and the world of politics and all that. No, I'm not going to become a politician. So I'm very happy doing this job for a few years, and then who knows after that.
John, I've learned a huge amount. It's been a fantastic interview. Thank you ever so much for your time.
Well, thank you, and thank you for coming to ITN.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things.